John chapter 20, verses 10 to 18. What's your vision of the future of humanity? Have you ever let your mind dream about the future of the human race? What does the future look like? Is it a future filled with new medication-resistant diseases or a bird flu epidemic? Is it a future filled with religious fascist empires or decayed and impotent capitalist regimes? Is it like that sort of a future? Maybe your dream future is instead populated with human beings whose average age is 200 due to new genetic developments and organ replacement. Perhaps you see a future of peace and near immortality as the products of technology give humanity the gifts that were once the prerogative of the gods. Futurism was an art movement of the first half of the 20th century. It wanted to reach forward, to grasp onto the future, to exalt youth and speed and technology over age and tradition. It was filled with a passion and a violence to bring about a technological future in which humanity would have overcome the mortality and limitations of this natural order, whether in painting, sculpture, poetry, opera, architecture, food, music, clothes design. They tried to promote an aggressive lust for the future. The leader of the movement was Filippo Marinetti, and in 1909 he produced the Manifesto of Futurism, and then in 1910 one of his colleagues wrote the Manifesto of Futurist Painters, in which he vowed this: "We will fight with all our might the fanatical, senseless, and snobbish religion of the past, a religion encouraged by the vicious existence of museums. We rebel against that spineless worshipping of old canvases, old statues, old bric-a-brac, against everything which is filthy and worm-ridden and corroded by time. We consider the habitual contempt for everything which is young, new, and burning with life to be unjust and even criminal. A rejection of the past in order to reach into the future." Well, it's kind of the opposite of what today is all about. On this Easter Sunday, we're gathered here because we're considering the claim that the future of the human race was seen when Jesus of Nazareth walked out of the tomb 2,000 years ago. The future of humanity is Jesus of Nazareth. We're considering the possibility that the future of humanity will not be determined by any positive or negative developments of history, but that the future of the universe itself belongs to an ancient carpenter who knew how to go through death and come out on the other side on this Easter Sunday evening. We're going to reach back into the past precisely in order to grasp the youngest, newest, and most burning with life future. We want to consider what kind of a future lies before the human race if there really was one man who paved the way for us all to be resurrected into immortal physical life when he returns to our world. We join the story very early on the Sunday morning in John 20, verse 10. Jesus had been dead since Friday afternoon. There can be no doubt about that, as is abundantly clear from any of the eyewitness accounts of his death. Now, at face value, that's the end of the story. A promising and talented leader is killed by this brutal regime. It's certainly not the only time such a story has been told. But there were at least two things that made this Sunday morning a little more complicated for those who had known Jesus. First, Jesus of Nazareth had often said that he would be resurrected on the third day after his death. Many other people have said this kind of thing, and obviously consistently failed to deliver. However, in the case of Jesus, he had brought a man back to life who'd been decaying in a tomb for 4 days. There was more to this man than mere words. Second, the ancient scriptures contain prophecies concerning the Messiah, the divine Redeemer. These ancient prophecies had an excellent record in accurately predicting the future. They'd successfully delivered that many, many times. And they were united in predicting that the divine Messiah would suffer death and then pass into immortality on the third day after his death. Now, this Jesus of Nazareth really did seem to be the promised divine Messiah. He'd done everything that the Messiah was supposed to do, and he even described himself as the Messiah, the Son of Man, who had all the power and authority in the universe. With all this in mind, we can perhaps understand why Mary Magdalene was having perhaps a sleepless night. Probably she wasn't clear what she should really do, but at the very least she should do is to make sure that Jesus' body was given a decent burial. True, she wasn't thinking straight. How was she going to move the massive stone that covered the tomb? But his body hadn't received the proper burial arrangements on the Friday evening. She had to do something. Mary Magdalene was a very strategic and wealthy woman. According to Luke 8, she was one of the women who financially supported Jesus and his disciples. And she's nearly always mentioned first in any lists of these supporters of Jesus' ministry. Dan Brown's fantasy that she was actually Mrs. Jesus has no basis in any evidence whatsoever, whether we examine Christian or non-Christian writings from the first centuries after Jesus. There's no credibility to that. But would she be Mrs. Jesus or is it Mrs. Christ? Is that the surname? Anyway, however, we do know some important things about this early Christian leader. According to John 19:25, she was one of the very few people who remained with Jesus right through his crucifixion until his death. Mark 15:47 tells us that she accompanied Mary, the mother of Jesus, to the burial place of Jesus. She was obviously a woman of deep theological reflection and maturity. That she was such a support to Jesus' mother at this time is a remarkable testimony to her strength. The idea that she was a prostitute has no basis in historical fact. It's an idea that came from a pope hundreds of years later. But she did have a difficult background before she ever met Jesus. We know this because in Luke 8 verse 2, we're told that at some earlier point, Jesus had delivered her from seven demons, driven seven demons out of her. This incredible experience of redemption by the power of Jesus clearly profoundly shaped her. So that, well, unlike the male disciples, Mary Magdalene stayed with Jesus right through the cross to his burial. It's against this background that we read John 20. Before any of the other disciples were up, Mary Magdalene awoke very early in the morning, while it was still dark, and went to the tomb of Jesus. When she saw that the stone covering the tomb had been removed, she alerted the rest of the disciples. On hearing Mary's news, Peter and John seemed to have a kind of race to see who could get to the tomb first. John, if you read the account, tells us several times that he in fact won that race, which obviously seemed important to him at the time he wrote his gospel for some reason. Perhaps he just wanted to set the record straight. I am faster than Peter. I just want that to be known. And Jesus loved me, you know, and that sort of thing. Peter and John saw that the tomb was empty and that Jesus' burial clothes had been neatly folded up. For Peter and John, that was all there was to see, and they just wandered off back to their homes, verse 10, and that's where we're in from verse 10. Now, that seems a strangely inadequate response to just wander home, to an inadequate response to what was at the very least an extremely intriguing turn of events. Mary Magdalene couldn't leave this empty tomb. She didn't cry out, "Christ is risen!" But did she wonder whether Jesus had really done what he promised he would? Did she suspect that Jesus had passed through death into immortality, just as he'd spoken of so many times, just as the ancient scriptures described so many times in so many ways? Who knows what she was thinking? But she stayed, and as she was weeping, she decided to examine the interior of the tomb for herself, verse 11. Mary was, at that time, apparently granted the ability to see the normally unseen angelic world that envelops this earthly level of reality there in verse 12. Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. Now, I don't know what you say or do when you see two angels, but Mary has a conversation with them. Verse 13, they asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They've taken my Lord away," she said. "I don't know where they've put him." I suppose they're not the most polite or sensitive angels. Not only do they address Mary as woman, but they also don't seem to realize that people do cry at burial places. People do grieve. It's not an unusual thing to do. Now, Mary's full of confusion and grief. Let's think of it from her perspective. She can see that Jesus is no longer in his tomb, and she can see that his burial clothes have been carefully removed from his body and folded neatly up. But she can't quite connect the dots. Have the enemies of Jesus taken his body away? These two angels are not very sympathetic to Mary's grief or confusion. From their perspective, the tears of Mary must have seemed very strange indeed. The one who created the whole universe had just walked through death into everlasting immortality. The future of humanity and the whole universe is the resurrected Jesus of Nazareth. And while they were there enjoying the moment in the tomb, a strange woman stuck her head into the tomb with a long and miserable face. "Woman, what are you crying about?" Surely she must understand that this was a day of intense joy, overwhelming celebration. It wasn't a day for grief and tears. Thankfully, there was someone present who could offer Mary a more understanding and personal encounter, verses 14 to 16. She turned round and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't realize it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I'll get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Mary turned round to see who'd arrived. She didn't realize it was Jesus. This sort of thing happens when we see a person in a context we didn't expect. Someone was telling me this week how his work colleagues simply didn't recognize him when he was handing out leaflets next to an Evening Standard newspaper salesman. They were used to seeing him in the work context, in the office, and didn't recognize him in this unexpected setting. He said that some even looked him in the eye, but failed to identify him because of the strange context. This seems to be the sort of thing that's happening to Mary. The last time she saw Jesus, his body was dead and mutilated. His side was torn open and his blood had drained from his body. She'd watched as that lifeless body had been buried in the tomb. That's what fills her mind. That's Jesus. Now, standing in front of her was a man of staggering life and vitality. A man who was as far from death as it is possible to be. A man for whom death was no longer an option. How could she recognize this man as the man whose body she was trying to locate? Again, she's addressed in this impersonal way. "Woman, why are you crying? Who are you looking for?" For Jesus, this was a morning of unsurpassable joy and victory. John's Gospel began with Jesus, the eternal Son of God, existing before the universe was created, and his death and resurrection had been planned since those eternal ages. The future of humanity and the universe had always been Jesus of Nazareth, and this resurrection was the fulfillment and guarantee of those plans. Jesus himself had been able to endure the burden of the cross only because he had focused on the joy of this resurrection morning all along. This resurrection morning had been on his mind a very, very long time. Now, perhaps less than an hour after his bodily resurrection, he stood reveling in the human life that lies on the other side of death. Can you imagine it? No one had ever experienced it before. He was the first, the forerunner. And he, just for maybe less than an hour, who certainly, you know, a few hours at most, he was living it, the first one ever. We cannot imagine the kind of thrilling and unquenchable life that must have flowed through him, a life that could never be touched by death or decay ever again. What a contrast between the utter joy and certainty of the resurrected Jesus and the confusion, grief, uncertainty of Mary and the other disciples. They failed to believe the scriptures, and now they were struggling to comprehend what had taken place. So far, Mary had been twice addressed impersonally as woman. But now, by contrast, she hears the very personal address in verse 16. Mary. Mary. Now she hears his voice. Now she recognizes who is speaking to her. Overcome with emotion, she speaks in a heart language, Aramaic. She thought he was the gardener, but calls him the teacher. John began his gospel, as we thought, with Jesus described as the Word, the Logos, the eternal divine logic of the whole universe. He is the explanation and blueprint for all created things, the knowledge and wisdom of the universe. Yeah, he's the teacher. He is the teacher, the holder of all knowledge and wisdom. Even though he's much more than a mere teacher, he certainly is the teacher. Mary hugs Jesus, as is implied by verse 17. For her, now everything is all right. The problems are all over. He'd always answered all the questions, driven away every problem. He'd healed all sicknesses, answered every need. And now that he passed through death into the glorious resurrection future, the whole world was different. Everything was wonderful now. It had been better than it ever was. Life now with Jesus would be better than it ever was. She was hugging onto the future of humanity. She was embracing the body and life that was the future of the whole creation. It was like travelling through time to the end of the world, and yet here she was, holding on to that ultimate resurrection future, right there, in the middle of a dying world, in the middle of a graveyard. Immortal human bodies. What a glorious vision. It's the dream that lies behind half the mythological stories in the world. Immortality. Could it be a reality? Could it be true? We began by thinking about the futurists, the artists who wanted to escape the past and pull the present into the future. The leader Marinetti dreamed of a future where the mortal human body could be replaced by perfect, undecaying metal body parts. Whole traditions of science fiction and anime reflect this futurist vision, clothing this mortality with a mechanical immortality. After 100 years, the same futurist vision teases the popular imagination. Professor Steve Jones of UCL speaks for a growing futurist vision when he describes a future in which our mortal bodies are repaired or renewed with the products of stem cell research. At its heart, this genetic vision can sometimes sound so like those earlier futurist visions of mechanical body parts, the replacement of these mortal bodies with immortal bodies produced by technological progress. It remains to be seen how the vision of the biological futurists will sound in another 100 years. Whatever the case, these futurist visions give us a perspective on Mary Magdalene in John 20, 16 to 18. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, which means teacher. Jesus said, Don't hold on to me, for I've not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, I've seen the Lord, and she told them that he'd said these things to her. Mary could see that whatever else the resurrection of Jesus meant, the world could never be the same. If the living God had really delivered on his promises to defeat death, then the future of humanity was transformed. Instead of looking down into the infinitely greedy mouth of death, the human race could lift its vision to a whole new kind of human life on the other side of the grave. If Christ is risen, this mortal life is now seen as a mere prologue for the real story of the world, which will be lived and told in an immortal future. Mary knew in that tight embrace that the future of humanity is Jesus of Nazareth. I suppose the modern world's not quite so used to thinking about physical resurrection as Mary in the first century. Coming out of the Hebrew scriptures, Mary would have recalled so many of the scriptures that promised the renewal of the heavens and the earth. Now that Jesus had returned from death, Mary did not want to let him go. She was clinging on to him so that she'd never let him go again. Those hours of feeling lost without him must never happen again. Perhaps she didn't realize how important he was until he'd been taken away. Now that he was back, she'd hold tightly onto him. And this is when Jesus introduces a gentle note of perspective. Yes, his resurrection had changed everything, but the world was going to continue as it was for the time being. He was going away to the Father. He'd often told his disciples that he had to return to his Father, and that's what he had to do in a short time. He wasn't going to just carry on with the normal life that they'd enjoyed for the last 3 years. His place was now in the throne room of the universe, filling all things and sending out his followers in his power by his Spirit, that the world might believe that he is the Son of God, and that by believing they might have life in him. He had to go away to prepare that resurrection future for his people. Yes, his resurrection is the guarantee of that overwhelmingly wonderful future. Yet, for now, he had to leave them. C.S. Lewis puts this best. Jesus says that he goes to prepare a place for us. The existence in the new state of anything that could in any sense be described as body at all involves in the long run a whole new universe. The existence in the new state of anything that could in any sense be described as body at all involves in the long run a whole new universe. The old field of space, time, matter, and the senses is to be weeded, dug, and sown for a new crop. We might be tired of that old field. God is not. On the day of his return, Jesus will renew all things, just as he promised. This old world cannot continue as it is. If it is to accommodate the immortality of the family of God, for now, Mary had to help the other disciples to realize that Jesus was only going to be physically with them for a few short weeks, verse 18. The future and the present could only physically overlap for a short time. The followers of Jesus needed to adjust to the excitement of that certain resurrection future, but also the readiness to be sent out now by Jesus into the world. That's where we are today. We've read the credible eyewitnesses of Jesus' resurrection and we're amazed by the accounts. We can sometimes, it's so real to us by the witness of the Spirit. We can almost taste that resurrection life now. And it seems too good to be true. We're like that. I can't wait for that. Can it really be true that one day we will all be back here on a renewed earth with immortal bodies, living in perfect fellowship with the living God, looking forward to everlasting life as it was always intended to be? With this certain hope before us, Jesus sends us out in the power of his Spirit to live his risen life and hold out the word of life to everyone we meet each day. As we awake, let our first thought be of that resurrection morning when our eyes will open from death onto a renewed creation under the perfect rule of King Jesus. Each night as we fall asleep, let our final thought be of the day when we close our eyes in death, trusting in the only one who's proved his power over death. As we go out, to serve and witness. Our hearts and minds must be full of that immortal future, ready and obedient to the commands of the one who has gone to his Father so that he can be our Father too. Therefore, to God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit be ascribed all the praise, all the glory, all the honour, all the majesty and all the power, now and forever. Amen.